Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Shankar Vedantam is NPR's social science correspondent and host of Hidden Brain. He speaks internationally on how unconscious bias shapes human behavior and on how the hidden brain influences everything from racial bias in professional settings to effective communication at work. Download the podcast version of Hidden Brain on your mobile device. Shankar Vedantam is in Sioux Falls for the announcement of Sanford's $1 million Lorraine Cross Award, and he's joining us in the Kirby Family Studio at SDPB's downtown Sioux Falls studio. Shankar, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Lori.
Cause a bit of a stir when you show up in the South Dakota Public Broadcasting Studios. We're all a little fan struck today.
I am delighted to be here.
Thank you. For folks who haven't heard Hidden Brain yet, first of all, they should, because it's my favorite podcast. Invisibilia and Hidden Brain are sort of the ones I'm always geeking out over. Tell people what the concept of the Hidden Brain is.
It's a show really about human behavior, and what it's trying to do is understand why we do what we do and give people insights that they can apply in their own lives. One of the things we try and do is we try and take topics that are in the news or off the news and try and show people that there are deeper patterns or deeper messages in some ways in how they can think about the news. And our hope is really to help people think about their own worlds, their own lives, their family lives, their personal lives, their professional lives, and the world in new and fresh ways.
So I'm in my car. I'm driving across the state of South Dakota. If you haven't done this, it's a beautiful drive, but it's a long drive. And I have several hours, and I pull up the feed. I'm just going to let it go. And I listen to one episode of Hidden Brain, and I have to stop and think about it for 2 hours before I listen to the next one. So, like, you think you're going to get through a lot, and you don't, because it's so compelling. And that happened to be an episode about gender and how we sort of dress our babies in pink and blue. And there was a woman who was saying, you know, I don't want to do that. And how that resonated in her family and life and some of the relationship damage that it caused. And I'm wondering how you find people, how you find ideas. What are you looking for?
So that story in some ways came to me accidentally. I was at a dinner. I was giving a talk at the Coast Guard Academy in New England, and I was having dinner with a group of people who worked at the Coast Guard, and one of them told me that he and his wife had been trying this, in some ways, this experiment to say if we believe that the way that many of us think about gender is shaped by environmental cues, can you raise a child without those environmental cues so that the child doesn't learn how to quote unquote be a boy or be a girl? How do you raise someone without a whole bunch of gender cues? And what happens? How does that child change as a result of being raised in this fashion? So stories come to us really in all kinds of different ways. The stories that pop up in conversation. Someone's having, you know, you're having dinner with someone, you're taking a walk with someone, something interesting happens on the news. And I think what we do at Hidden Brain is we sort of say, how do we take this little moment, this little idea, and show that it actually reveals great things about all of our natures? I think when you think about human behavior, you know, we see so much of it around us all the time that we don't often stop and look at it with curiosity, that the things that people do in their daily lives, the everyday things that people do, how they interact with each other, how they sit in an auditorium, who speaks first when they're called upon to speak, these things reveal deep patterns about human behavior. And if you look carefully and you follow the science carefully, there are insights that are very helpful and revealing.
Yeah. So we're living in a time when it's fairly easy to not stop and to, you know, have decided about certain things politically, you know, on your faith journey and your family life, what clothes you should buy for a girl baby, what clothes you should buy for a boy baby. How did you personally sort of come at this notion of it's worth stopping and thinking about why? And then tell me how you surround yourself with other people who want to be part of this process and who are saying, I wonder what that means. Let's look into it.
In many ways, this is one of the fundamental ideas of the Hidden Brain Project as a whole. And in some ways, when I began the journey, which really began with the book that I wrote, The Hidden Brain, about 10 years ago, it grew out of the insight that much of our lives we live on autopilot. We think we're acting intentionally and deliberately and rationally. But in fact, habits and rules and heuristics and norms are shaping how we behave. What I call the world of the hidden brain, shapes how we behave without even thinking about it. And so in some ways, the fact that much of us live our lives without paying attention to what's happening around us, this is how the brain is actually designed to work. It's actually designed to speed you through your day so you're not paying attention to most of what's happening around you, because evolution has shaped your brain to really focus on the things that it thinks are the most important. So what we are trying to do on Hidden Brain is say, let's stop and take a look at what that process is. Let's try and understand how relationships form. Let's try and take a look and understand how relationships come apart. Let's understand how partisanship works. Let's understand how collaboration works. And if you look at it closely, there are things that are very valuable that you can learn. So I don't think we are saying that the autopilot function that we have in our brains is a bad thing. It actually is very useful to not have to think about every single thing as you go through your life. But it is the case that if you stop and think about some of those things and then try and modify some of those things, you can make changes that could be very helpful to you.
Right. So this is how I can listen to the podcast in the car while I'm driving, because my hidden brain is sort of driving the car, even though I'm paying attention to it as well as I should be. I don't have to think about breathing and brain function and my heart and how to get where I want to go, because I've sort of got that on autopilot.
Exactly. Now, if you were a new driver, on the other hand, right, you would probably turn the radio down. And you would turn the radio down and focus on the driving, because much more of your conscious brain needs to be focused on driving. But if you drive enough, then you become skilled enough that much of what you need to know as a driver gets transferred to your hidden brain, at which point it becomes largely automatic. You're not really thinking, when I get into the car, where do I put in my key in the ignition? Where's the gas pedal? How do I move the steering wheel? These have become automatic. You've learned them over many, many years of practice. And now your conscious brain is freed up to do other things, like listen to the Hidden Brain podcast.
And this is a positive thing, but also some of these stories are tragic as well. And you mentioned the book, The Hidden Brain. And the introduction of that has a story of a woman who was raped, and it was daylight, and somebody came onto her patio, came into her apartment. She memorizes everything about him, because at the point she realizes she cannot escape the situation, she knows that she wants to seek justice, and she does so. And through a long story, which is beautifully told in the introduction, she's wrong. It turns out she's wrong, and she doesn't find this out. And it has to do with really how our brain fills in details, things that the police officers didn't think to ask because it was filling in detail. Explain a little bit about some of that's scary in a way, to think that these things are happening, and they're happening in our minds as well.
That's exactly right. When you think about your own world, it's actually understandable why your brain gives you a sense of certainty as you go through your life. It gives you a sense of certainty that you know where you are, that you've made the judgments you've arrived at, that you've thought carefully about things, because in some ways it's destabilizing, as you just indicated in your question, to recognize that there might be forces outside our control that are shaping our behavior. So our brain is actually very skillful at giving us the illusion that we actually have thought about everything carefully and deliberately and intentionally, when in fact we've not. We haven't. In the story that you mentioned, the woman who was very sincere and wanted to make sure that the right person was arrested, misidentified somebody as being her assailant, and she did so out of the best of intentions. She really thought that she had basically done her homework and had done due diligence, and the police thought they had done due diligence. And in many ways, their hidden brains were manipulating them to come to a wrong conclusion. And the moral of the story is not that all of us make mistakes, we shouldn't trust anything that we say or do. That's not the moral of the story. The moral of the story really is to understand how and when the hidden brain is taking over the controls of the plane. So in other words, it's fine to have a pilot, and it's fine to have an autopilot function on the plane. In fact, it's very useful to have an autopilot function on the plane. But when you're flying through a storm, that might not be the best time to hand over controls to the autopilot. When we're making decisions, important decisions affecting our lives, the lives of other people, that might be precisely the time when you want to take control back and tell your hidden brain, thank you very much, you're very useful, but I want you to take a back seat right now. I want to take the controls and think about ways I can protect myself against bias and against error.
And one of these moments that you talk about in that introduction is she's overcoming her own self-doubt, and she goes to church, which is a place of sanctuary for her, and she sits, and this feeling of calmness and like, yep, I know that this is the right thing to do comes over her. And talk about those connections between that emotional feeling of contentment and how that is sort of triggering something in our decision-making process.
Sure. So at any given time, you know, our brains are trying to do multiple things. And so in this case, you know, she was evaluating whether someone whom the police had presented to her as a possible suspect was in fact the perpetrator. And she was having some internal self-doubt about it, which was anxiety-provoking and was making her uncomfortable. So she went to the space that she felt was a safe space, a quiet space, a place of healing. And she felt relaxed, she felt happy, which is, of course, what the place does for her, because she went to church because going to church gave her a sense of calm, gave her a sense of peace. But what she did was she mistook the sense of calm and the sense of peace she felt when she was at church for a sense of certainty about the person whom the police was placing before her. So in other words, when you feel a sense of calm and peace, it could be many things. It could be because you're in a place that's bringing about calm and peace, but it could also be because you've actually decided who the perpetrator is and you no longer have this doubt. And so in some way, she transferred over the peace and security she felt in the physical setting to a sense of peace and security about the decision she was making. In some ways, her anxiety, her worry, her concern that she might not have been picking the right person, that concern was actually her friend at that point, because even though it felt uncomfortable to her, it was prompting her in a direction that would have gotten the answer right. By providing a sense of security a little bit early, that actually deprived her of the sense of worry that was essentially the fire alarm. You know, so when you have a smoke alarm go off in your house, there's two things you can do. The smoke alarm is extremely upsetting. And so some of us, what we do is we just disable the smoke alarm. And of course, that stops the upsetting sound, but now you don't have a smoke alarm anymore, and you might have a fire raging inside your house. And so the moral of that story, again, was to think about when the hidden brain was sort of influencing us, how it's influencing us, and then also to think about ways to address this. So in other words, if you're aware that eyewitness testimony can sometimes be biased, can sometimes be flawed, what are the ways in which you can actually present information to witnesses in order to minimize the risks of bias? In other words, once you understand how the hidden brain works, you can start to ask the question, how do we figure out how to make sure that the information we're getting out of the brain is in fact accurate?
And how fast is brain science changing and increasing our understanding of how the brain and the hidden brain is operating?
So brain science is exploding. There is new discoveries being made almost every single day. But I will say that in some ways, the work that's been done at the level of the neuroscience and at the level of what's happening inside the cellular structure of the brain is not necessarily very revealing about what's happening at a psychological level. And the way I think about this is that you're flying over, I just flew into Sioux Falls yesterday, so I'm thinking about airplane analogies for some reason. But let's imagine you're on an airplane, you're flying 30,000 feet above the earth. You look down, you have a sweep, a sense of what the earth looks like beneath you, because at a glance you can see, you know, a 300 square mile area. When you're working in the neuroscience, you're actually mapping out the terrain tree by tree, street by street, house by house. And that's incredibly valuable to do, because understanding those basic building blocks will eventually give us a much better sense of the map. But at the psychological level, really, our brain is operating like you're flying in that plane 30,000 feet above the ground. You know, what's happening at the neuroscience level does not immediately translate to be able to say, I now recognize that the tree is actually, you know, 6 feet away to the left from my previous map. That's not really going to help you when you're 30,000 feet up in the air trying to see the broad terrain. So there's a lot of change, a lot of developments, but in some ways, understanding the psychology of what's happening is not quite the same as understanding the neuroscience of what's happening.
I want to talk a little bit about the role of empathy in this program and the work that you do, because as I listened to, I listened to the Founding Contradiction, which was a story about Thomas Jefferson's stance on slavery. You interviewed Annette Gordon Reed, author who was at the South Dakota Festival of Books recently, and really kind of diving into this idea of how we look at the founders and the hypocrisy, some people would use that word, or the contradictions of someone like Jefferson writing about freedom and liberty and equality while literally his slave brings him, you know, waits on him while he does this writing in Sally Hemings. And so much was, and at the end of it, there's so many questions that you're able to sit with no easy answers, but also this sense of understanding what it means to be human from Sally's perspective, from the slave perspective, from Jefferson's perspective, from Lafayette's perspective. So talk a little bit about empathy and how just learning about human behavior and the brain science helps people see their lives in a new way.
Mm. I would actually argue this is even more than brain science. This is almost what journalism does. I mean, this is what public broadcasting does, I think. You know, when you think about what public radio does all the time, you're bringing in new voices. And each time you bring in a new voice, your picture of what you're seeing changes. So, you know, when I lived in Philadelphia for a few years and you go to Liberty House and you can see where Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence. And it's really stirring and moving to see, you know, those words, "We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal." And so you have a picture of Jefferson that forms from that. And then I speak to Annette Gordon Reed, and from her I learned that even as Jefferson was writing those words, he was being waited on by a 14-year-old African-American slave. And then you sort of have a reversal. You sort of say, well, how could you be writing, "We hold these truths to be self-evident," at the same time you're being attended on by a slave? And then you draw the conclusion, well, you must be a hypocrite. And then you sort of say, well, from Jefferson's point of view, he was actually waging two different struggles at the same time. He was actually trying to create a new country. And the challenges of creating a new country and holding together the various constituents that were needed to hold that, to build that new country, took precedence over his concerns about the institution of slavery. And so each time you sort of hear a new piece of information, it's like a map that basically is being updated each time. And each update basically gives you a more complex and nuanced picture. And what I think is beautiful about that is actually it allows you to think about your own life. And I think it's when we look at other people's lives, it's easy for us to draw quick conclusions, to sort of say, well, this must be obviously a great person, this must be a villain, this must be a good person, a bad person. When we look at our own lives, we understand the complexity of the lives that we face, the contradictions that are built into the fabric of our lives. And, you know, not necessarily at the levels of, you know, are you for slavery or against slavery, but just ordinary contradictions that we are, you know, we are professionals, but we also have family lives and we have friends and we're trying to balance all these things together and we're making trade-offs between them all the time. And these nuances are part of what makes us who we are, what makes us human. You talked about empathy in the question. In many ways, I think the goal of The Hidden Brain is to show ourselves, to show us to ourselves, to reveal us to ourselves. In some ways, I think some of the best Hidden Brain episodes are episodes where all we're doing is holding up a mirror so people can sort of recognize something in themselves. And when I heard Jefferson's story described by Annette Gordon Reed, even though, you know, I have never written the Declaration of Independence, I don't live in momentous times, I could see echoes in my own life of the contradictions of things that I believe but I don't always practice, things that I want to do but don't always do. And I think that's the goal of the show, to tell people, you know, that the stories that you see on the outside reveal things about yourself.
How has this changed you? You sort of, at the end of your episode with Annette Gordon Reed, you asked her about her own bias, and she spoke eloquently to that. When you do, you know, an episode, do you look back and think about how you're bringing your own bias to the creation of the journalistic work that you do?
Absolutely. I think every episode at Hidden Brain that I've done at Hidden Brain has reminded me of some flaw that I have. And part of the reason we've been as prolific as we have at Hidden Brain is that I have many flaws.
And so it's working. Yeah.
There's an endless supply of things to talk about, endless number of biases to talk about. We've, I think, done many things at Hidden Brain that try to, in some ways, internalize the message of the show. One of the things that I am most proud of is that I think we have tried very hard to try and address the gender imbalance in the sources we have on the show. And so we take considerable pains to try and actually keep track of how often we feature men and women on the show. And we're, I think, one of the very few shows across the public radio universe that has essentially a 50-50 split on men and women sort of speaking on the show. And again, I think that's an example of our taking the research, taking the findings, and applying that insight to our own lives, of trying to understand how is it that you have these huge gender disparities appear in all kinds of different fields, and what can we do in some ways to put our shoulder to the wheel to not be part of the problem and be part of the solution.
Do you find yourself making moral judgments of a guest, of a story, of a concept, of a newsmaker? Is it hard? Are you trying to suspend moral judgment, or is there a time and place to say, you know, that's, you know, we're clear about that. That's absolutely wrong.
You know, I have to say, I don't think I'm a very judgmental person. I think my primary response is often curiosity. I want to understand why someone is doing what they're doing, how they have come to understand what they're doing. It's not like I don't have opinions. I do have opinions. But I'm not sure I see my role necessarily as being their judge or the judge of the people who come and talk to us on Hidden Brain. I think part of what the show is talking about is that listening to people with empathy, with compassion, even for people who are not necessarily the best people, even the people who are not the heroes, it has value and it reveals us to ourselves. There are things in all of us that are wonderful and heroic, and there are things in all of us that are not grand, that are weak and afraid and self-doubting, and we cut corners, and there are things that we do that are not great. And I think holding up a mirror, as I said, means holding up a mirror to both the good stuff and the bad stuff.
Do you see the impact of the work that you do? I mean, you know, you talk to a listener like me and you can hear how it's affected my life and changed how I see things. It certainly informed how I do this program. So I thank you personally for that. But do you see other things, you know, policy issues, you know, different things that are changing because of the work that you're doing on Hidden Brain?
We get a lot of feedback from listeners who say that, you know, the show and the stories in the show are helping them think about their worlds differently. Now, I don't know how many of them are actually trying to go the next step of going from insight to action, which is to say, now I have the insight that something isn't working for me. Let me actually go and do something about it. That's obviously a much harder step. I certainly think that we are playing some role, and I think public radio and public broadcasting plays this role writ large of helping people think about their lives more broadly and helping lead to a more informed public. I know that's often in our, you know, our slogans and bumper stickers, but it actually, I think, is true. Public broadcasting is an enormous vehicle for education and for helping people see the bigger picture.
What's coming up on the show? What's next? What are some of the episodes that we don't know that you're working on?
Well, I am someone who lives relentlessly in the future. So okay. If you actually ask me what I did last week or last night, I usually have no recollection of it, but I have a pretty good sense of what I'm going to be doing 3 months from now. So we are working on a number of different shows, very, very different kinds of shows. One of the shows that I think I'm really intrigued by, the topic I'm really intrigued by, is the idea that many of us are increasingly living vicariously through others. Mm. So we love to watch cooking shows instead of actually going out and spending time cooking ourselves. We love to watch sports instead of actually playing sports ourselves. Then our screens in some ways have come to be a substitute for the real things in our lives. Certainly, for example, if you think about pornography and the role that pornography is playing in our lives, the screen in some ways has come to be a substitute for what we actually would do in our real lives. And again, I think our goal at Hidden Brain is not to sort of sit in judgment of the phenomenon, but to actually just look at it and to look at it with curiosity and with compassion and to say, why is this happening and what are the consequences of it happening? Maybe there are good consequences and maybe there are bad consequences, but what are the consequences of essentially living vicariously through other people?
How did you end up in journalism? Because you began as an engineer. Let's learn a little bit about you and how you ended up on this path.
You know, I think like most things in life, it happened completely by accident. I was always interested in writing, and I always was, you know, freelancing articles and writing articles for papers, and I did a lot of writing, and I was always drawn to words, I think. And so I spent the first 20 years of my journalism career in print journalism, first at the Philadelphia Inquirer, and then at the Washington Post. And was at the Washington Post, really, I was covering mostly mental health and psychiatry. When I started to move away from the mental illness side of the spectrum to the human behavior end of the spectrum, so to look at, I realized it's not just the people who have mental disorders whose behavior is interesting and worth noting and understanding. It's actually people who don't have mental disorders whose behavior is also fascinating, whose behavior is worth following. And so the Hidden Brain really grew out of this evolution, and it's an evolution like most things. You know, you don't quite know what's going to happen. We featured Dan Gilbert, who is a psychologist at Harvard University, on the podcast many months ago, and he said something really interesting, which is when we look back on our lives and we look forward to our lives, at every stage of our lives, we believe that we have changed a great deal compared to 10 years ago. But when we look forward and you ask people, how much do you think you're going to change in the next 10 years? People invariably say, I don't think I'm going to change very much. So the 20-year-old believes that when they're 30, they're going to be like they're 20. The 40-year-old believes that she's going to be like she is at 40 when she's at 50. But each decade, when you look backward, you see that there's enormous change. And so there's some illusion here where we believe that we're fully baked when in fact we're not, right? And so I think the moral of that story is that we are in fact constantly changing. And things lead on to things in ways that are often unpredictable, as Robert Frost would say in one of his poems. And it's often the, you know, the path less traveled by that actually makes all the difference.
I remember the first time I realized that as an adult, that somebody who was 80 is still feeling, you know, the same way they felt when they were 18. I mean, that awareness that you get maybe in your mid-40s where you're like, wait a minute, this isn't going to change. I'm always going to be looking at
right.
Shankar Vedantam, NPR social science correspondent, host of Hidden Brain. What a privilege to have you in the studios here. We really appreciate your time today. Download the podcast, please. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Lori.